Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. My name is Anne Wilson, and I'm delighted to be hosting this special series of Emerge Australia podcasts in preparation for Severe ME Week. In this series, I'll be interviewing those with severe ME and others with lived experience and their carers, as well as eminent clinicians working in the challenging yet exciting field of infection-associated chronic illnesses like ME, long COVID, and associated overlapping conditions. This season is particularly important to Emerge Australia as we launch our Count ME campaign, designed to ensure the ME community is counted in data across the health system and in decisions that affect our community's lives at a time when ongoing funding for Emerge Australia's patient services is not guaranteed. To commence today, I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles, and achievements. As we continue to reflect on the magnificent lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, never has there been a greater need in my lifetime for the world to celebrate the brotherhood of man globally. A world without stigma, a world without discrimination on any grounds, a world where people have equity of access to treatments and medical care, a world where we have biomarkers and diagnostic tests for those with ME and associated conditions, and dare I dream a world where we have a cure for these diseases. Today, I'm absolutely delighted to introduce and welcome Dr. Alexis Cutchins to our podcast coming direct from the USA in New York. Welcome, Dr. Cutchins, and I hope it's okay for me to call you Alexis.
Yes, of course. So happy to be here.
Oh, wonderful. Dr. Alexis Cutchins has received numerous awards, published and presented meticulous research, and spoken on many platforms and on various topics, including recently at the Australian POTS Foundation Conference, where I first heard you speak. Dr. Cutchins completed her residency in New York and fellowship in Virginia before practicing as a clinical cardiologist for 13 years in Atlanta. Her accolades were for helping people who struggled to find a diagnosis that felt right and to receive help from a provider who listened, music to our ears. Her own practice offers advanced cardiology service with a focus on POTS, MCAS, hypermobility spectrum disorders, long COVID, and other complex chronic conditions through patient-centered, inclusive, and expert-led care. She loves working alongside people just as dedicated as she is to giving patients compassionate and comprehensive care. And don't we wish everybody in the medical profession had that passion? Alexis, welcome. And to start off, can you tell us a little bit more about your background and really what drew you to specialize in complex chronic conditions like POTS, MCAS, and long COVID, and how that experience from your perspective relates to ME CFS?
Yeah, so I trained as a cardiologist, When I started out as a medical student, I kind of thought I was going to be a surgeon or maybe an OBGYN. I thought it was going to be more kind of interventional, procedural-based career. And I got swayed early on, you know, towards the end of medical school to go into an internal medicine residency. And I was told by one of my mentors that I asked too many questions to be in a surgical subspecialty. And that really resonated with me. I think she really recognized that I wasn't satisfied with not knowing the answer. So I have a very curious personality. And I went on to internal medicine. I decided to go into cardiology because I also like fixing things and I like things. I like to see a result. I like that instant gratification. And so I think the combination of my brain wanting to fix things and the curiosity that I have to try to discover what's going on leads me into this world of the unknown, you know, this complex chronic illness space where we don't have any answers and we really don't, you know, we really don't have finite cures or quick fixes. And I think I really wanted to try to do whatever I could for this population of patients to try to figure out what those fixes were going to be or try to support them in this journey to trying to understand what the underlying causes of their symptoms are. And so as far as ME-CSF is concerned, in the terms of the overlap with what I do, you know, I started off seeing patients with POTS primarily because I'm a cardiologist. They came to me for high heart rate and passing out, syncope, you know, shortness of breath, exercise intolerance. And after learning about that population of patients more and more, I realized they had other comorbid conditions like hypermobility spectrum disorder, mast cell activation syndrome, ME-CSF, and, you know, vascular compression syndromes, all these things that kind of overlap in this population. And one of those is this kind of neuroinflammatory, hypoxic brain, you know, state that is causing them this chronic severe fatigue. And so I think there's a huge overlap in all of these patients. I would say it's rare for me to find a patient with POTS who doesn't have chronic fatigue. It's not that it doesn't occur. I definitely see it. But it's uncommon. And so it's just one of those things that overlaps with the complex chronic illness space.
Yeah. One of our medical and scientific advisory board members, Dr. Emma Tippett, who runs Clinic 19 in Australia, which is a service of a group of specialists that look after infection-associated chronic disease, but primarily long COVID, recently said in a parliamentary friends group meeting that we held that all her long COVID patients had ME-CFS. Could you maybe also just quickly explain for us, do all of these chronic and complex conditions really come under the term that is being used more and more now, and that is dysautonomia? Can you explain where?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think dysautonomia is a great adjective, I guess, that does encompass a lot of the symptoms that all these patients have. But there are different forms of dysautonomia. There's primary dysautonomias, like multi-system atrophy and, you know, real true autonomic dysfunction at a primary level. And then there's POTS, MCAS, ME-CFS, this whole kind of constellation of things that have symptoms of dysautonomia. And so I think in the setting of POTS, in the setting of MCAS, in the setting of ME-CFS, all of those conditions have dysautonomia as part of them, but it may be driven by other things like mast cell activation syndrome, or there might be a different driver that's raising heart rates like pelvic venous congestion and venous pooling. And so I think there's a huge overlap and it's hard to tease out. And I think of dysautonomia in its most pure form as more of a like neurologic multi-system atrophy, completely different scenario than what we're seeing in this kind of constellation of disease processes.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for explaining that. And I ask that because I'm hearing dysautonomia. So I've only been the CEO of Emerge Australia for 5 years. And I'm not a clinician, I'm an allied health professional, but I'm hearing dysautonomia being referenced more and more.
Mm-hmm.
the last couple of years. And sometimes it can be a bit confusing for patients, you know. Well, you know, I might have ME/CFS, but I've also got orthostatic intolerance and I've been told I've got POTS. Who do I listen to more? You know, what voice is the one that's going to be the right one for me? How do patients work that jigsaw puzzle out, particularly when, and I'm finding this very much so in this patient cohort compared to different patient cohorts I've worked with in the past, this is an extremely knowledgeable patient cohort, you know, as a result of their fatigue, etc. They have educated themselves online about, you know, every aspect of potential treatment. But, you know, sometimes there's a separation out of POTS that doesn't mention ME/CFS. And yet I hear clinicians like Emma saying, well, all of my patients have got ME/CFS, the ones that have got long COVID. And then you
just hard.
Confused. So, you know.
So I think there's a difference between orthostatic intolerance and dysautonomia. And we know that in the ME/CSF community, there's a large driver of lack of blood flow to the brain that is part of this constellation of symptoms. I would say the biggest driver of chronic fatigue is lack of blood flow to the brain. We see that in POTS. We see that in vascular compression syndromes. And then, you know, and so when you think of lack of blood flow to the brain, orthostatic intolerance, if you categorize that as POTS, then people also call it dysautonomia, which I think is a mislabel personally. Not all POTS is necessarily dysautonomia. If you're not thinking of it as an orthostatic intolerance, then you're thinking of it as in this kind of neuroimmune setting, which is more autoimmune, inflammatory, infectious related symptoms that are causing fatigue as well. And I think that's a portion of ME/CFS, but not the majority, which are mostly this orthostatic intolerance. So you can have the orthostatic intolerance in ME/CFS without meeting criteria for POTS. This is where it gets, you know, crazy, right?
Yeah.
And so we're still treating the ME/CFS orthostatic intolerance like we treat POTS. But do you call that dysautonomia?
Yeah.
I guess not.
Yeah.
But it's really kind of the same thing. But I don't use the word dysautonomia to describe POTS, you know, uniquely, because I think that POTS is a symptom of a larger picture, which is a combination of many different things, including, but not limited to, mast cell activation syndrome, autoimmune disease, vascular compression syndromes, you know, hypermobility, cranial cervical instability, Chiari malformation. You know, I mean, I could go on and on and on, right? And the POTS itself is literally just your heart rate goes up by 30 beats per minute going from lying to standing at any given time, and you have dizziness with that or some symptom, and you're labeled with POTS. But then do we go from there and say you have all this like dysautonomia because you just met that one criteria? It doesn't make sense to me.
No. Yeah, thank you for clarifying that.
Well, I wish I could be more clear. I think we need to change the narrative a little bit, and people are starting to talk about this and work on that, that POTS really is like the criteria for POTS aren't really great. We shouldn't be, you know, classifying it as specifically strictly 30 beats per minute because older people don't have that heart rate rise in the same way. You know, there's a lot of conversations going on about this. And so I think that things are changing in this space. And I think there is some POTS that is a primary dysautonomia, or you can have like an autoimmune autonomic ganglionopathy that causes POTS. That's, you know, pretty straightforward, right? And so, yeah, there's a lot of overlap, unfortunately.
Yeah. So that actually leads me to looking at one of your slides that you put up at the POTS conference, and it's the 10 key drivers of symptoms in chronic complex illness. Can you talk a little bit about those and then talk about the LIFT acronym? Because you also talked about the silos that in medicine that diseases fall under. And I think That is one of the biggest challenges. Then there's also a challenge in what I would call nomenclature. You know, you've got these silos and then you've got these medical specialties that sort of relate to those silos. Then you've got these organizations that relate to the diseases in the silos. Left hand often doesn't know what the right hand is doing. There's competition for funding. You know, is there another way?
Yeah, I know. So that was a lot. I'm going to start with the silos and maybe work my way back.
Yeah.
If I can remember what the rest of the questions were. But as far as the silos are concerned, this is a major problem in medicine. I think what's happened over the years is that we've become more and more subspecialized. As medicine advances, there's more and more treatment options. There are more and more medications that we have to learn, more procedures, more and more specialization because there's so much medicine, right? So as our knowledge of the human body and of medicine and how to practice it evolves and enlarges, we have to continue to kind of subspecialize people, surgeons or practitioners into more and more narrow spaces so that we can have experts in these things, right? But the problem is once that ball grows too big, once you get, you know, so many different specialties and everyone is just focusing on their one thing, there's no one stepping back and saying, wait a second, why does this patient have 10 of these specialists working on them? Like, what's the problem, right? Yeah. And this is where we need to start shifting medicine to coming back to thinking about the whole person. The problem is that the doctor you want to be doing that is your internal medicine, primary care physician, GP. But the GP can't possibly know everything about all these different things, right? And certainly they don't have enough time to go over all of these different subspecialties because they've only been given 15 minutes or 10 minutes to be with each patient, right? So how are they supposed to even get to a point where they can recognize that all of these different complaints that the patient has are actually maybe interrelated and interconnected? And so it shifts medicine out of the role of the PCP, the 15-minute visit, into these subspecialties, and then it's a vicious cycle, right? Because those subspecialties are just going to do individually what they need to do. And what we need in medicine to especially take care of this population of patients is a system that recognizes that these patients need doctors who understand all of it. And I think ultimately what we need is a specialty for this population of patients, which I think is going to end up in a hypermobility spectrum disorder space because in my opinion, it's that underlying abnormality in connective tissue that's then predisposing patients to have the reactions they have to infections, the lack of immune support to chronic post-infectious illness, the vascular compression syndromes because their compression, their connective tissue is not working properly, the mast cell activation syndrome because their mast cells aren't working properly. You know, we need a specialty of medicine that understands this population of patients. And it can't be the internal medicine doctor or the primary care physician because they don't have time to do that, you know? So I think that's where I'm hoping medicine's going to evolve eventually.
Yeah.
But it's going to take some time because that kind of medicine and that kind of care for this population of patients is not reimbursed by, at least in the U.S., insurance properly. And we don't have time to sit with these patients in my clinic where I don't accept insurance and it becomes a financial barrier to a lot of patients, which I know and I, you know, am not happy about, but it's kind of the only way that I can have enough time to figure out what's going on with someone, right? I need that 90-minute visit. So this is, I think, what we need. We need this evolution or this shift to occur.
Yeah. And in Australia, to be fair, we do have a government subsidy for longer visits, but it's not enough for the average GP, you know, to be spending the amount of time that they need to, especially when it comes to an initial diagnosis. That's still a major challenge for us here in Australia. And then the major challenge is that, you know, most of our established primary care physicians haven't studied chronic and complex decisions in grad school. So, you know, they actually don't have the underpinning knowledge that is required to actually investigate when these patients walk through the door, and that then often leads to years without a diagnosis. And I guess that leads us into some patients with severe ME, which of course is incredibly misunderstood and, you know, is not only hugely disruptive and disabling for the person and their family, but is also expensive to the health system. So my question is, how can healthcare providers improve their understanding and support for those with severe ME?
Such a good question. I think certainly that's why I do this kind of podcast, is because I'm hopeful that, you know, people will listen and recognize that this population is there. I think until we have more research and more defined pathways for treatment of this population of patients, which aren't there yet, we're not going to be able to educate primary care physicians to go through the algorithm of getting patients, you know, evaluated, diagnosed, and treated, right? And so, but the problem is, if you're working back from that, well, how do you get funding to treat a population of, or to evaluate a population of people that not everyone understands or believes exists, right? I mean, there's so much kind of dismissal of this population, you know, because they have labs that look normal. They have tests that look normal. Everyone says, you know, it must just be your psychological inability to get out of bed, and that's why you're so tired. And obviously, we know that's not true. These patients, the last thing they want, and the one that I hate, is the doctor shopping. You know, it's like, oh, you're just trying to find a doctor who's going to do what you want and tell you you have what you have. And this is not, you know, I'm not going to do that. You know, I think it's horrible when these patients get pinned as sort of like, they're just trying to find an answer. And no, they're not psychologically driven to see 10 doctors in a week. Like, no one wants to do that. No one wants to do that. This is not a problem. This is just the patients doing their absolute best to try to find someone who's going to give them some kind of answer and some kind of hope and some kind of path to feeling a little bit better, because they feel so, so horrible and they're so debilitated, right? So we need the mindset to shift. And I don't know where that happens. Medical school. I think, you know, I do think there's a shift occurring in social media and in, you know, kind of public access to patients who are talking about their story and their journey and what helped them and, you know, how they got diagnosed. This is helping other patients ask the right questions to their doctors. Well, you know, like, can I get evaluated for this particular thing? And so I think there's a patient-centered movement that's really helpful, that's working, that seems to be kind of reliant on social media. But then there's also the need for us to teach this more in medical school and to, you know, kind of grassroots get things, get doctors aware. I don't know how we're going to get more research and more answers, because the problem is we don't have answers. And so I think one way is to observe clinics like mine and other people who are having success with these patients and take what we're doing and the successes that we're having and bring that back to research, right? And say, you know, this doctor seems to be having success with this population of patients, and here are the things she's looking at and she's doing, not just me, other doctors who take care of this population of patients, right? And let's take what she's doing and go back and get the data to prove that what she's doing is, you know, is working in this population so that we can build guidelines.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And the beauty is that it's as relevant for you in the US as it is for us in Australia. I think we're a little behind where you guys are as far as ME/CFS and these complex chronic energy limiting conditions. So from your perspective, what are some of the most effective approaches to patient-centered and inclusive care, and how can these be applied to support people with ME? Because as you say, you know, no one wakes up in the morning and saying, I'm going to be bedbound for the next X amount of time. I don't want to get out of bed. I mean, I don't know anyone who could even fathom thinking that. These people are sick. So what are some of the things that you have seen that have worked or might be helpful to this severe population.
Yeah, so I think one thing we have to keep in mind in the population of patients with ME/CSF is post-exertional malaise, which is a component of the condition, right? So baseline, everyone has to understand that if you're doing anything that pushes you to a point where you're going to have a crash or you're going to feel worse afterwards, we have to back up from that point. And that might get us to a point where you're really not doing much at all, but we have to slowly and incrementally increase activity, you know, until we can get to a point where patients are doing minimal activity without the crash, and then slowly and incrementally add to that activity level. And I'm saying walking to the bathroom and back to the bed once a day, you know, can you do that, right? Starting off slow and slowly, starting off with minimal activity and slowly working your way up. That's step number one. It's important to optimize sleep. These patients don't feel good in the morning when they wake up. They feel like they haven't slept, even though they're sleeping for 12 hours. The quality of their sleep is not appropriate. And so we need to work on getting sleep in the best possible place for them, because the better your sleep, the better everything else is going to function during the day, the better your body is going to be able to heal and take care of itself, right? So that's a really big priority. Handling triggers of symptoms is super important. So if you're living in a home that has mold, or if your environment is full of perfumes or something else that triggers your symptoms, you have to, you know, you have to move, you have to get rid of that environment. You have to take yourself and put yourself in a place where you're not triggered by your surroundings. That's very important. But also the foods that you eat, you have to be careful that you're providing yourself nourishing foods that are not triggering any symptoms. And sometimes that means eliminating one food at a time to try to figure out if there's a specific food or part of your diet that is kind of causing you to have more triggering or more symptoms. And sometimes I usually recommend to patients that you do this kind of for a month at a time with one food group or one food.
Elimination. Yeah.
Elimination, yeah. But not so dramatic that you're not eating anything, but you know, trying to kind of figure it out one food group at a time so that you're still eating other foods. And so, you know, and then it's a matter of treating, like looking for things and treating, right? So, and that is, it's such a tricky system because I don't have a perfect algorithm. Every single patient's different. Every single patient responds to different things. But I often find that even starting with the basics of mast cell activation syndrome treatment, which is H1 and H2 blockers, like your Allegra, Zyrtec, Claritin, or Hepcid, Zantac kind of medications can make a huge difference in this population of patients. And it should be noted that sometimes one works and another one doesn't. So if you try one and it doesn't work, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't try the other three, you know, because those might work for you. And so getting some, you know, mast cell targeted therapy on, I think can make a big difference for patients, not everyone, but it really can help. And then working with a doctor who can escalate that therapy to, you know, more advanced mast cell targeted therapies, I think is helpful. In my world, you know, of POTS and low cerebral blood flow, I look at heart rate. I talk about really increasing volume of fluids and salt intake, compression socks to try to get all the blood volume back in that intravascular space and up to the brain, but also then medications if needed, which, you know, if we slow the heart rate, we have a bigger stroke volume, better cardiac output to the brain. If we can raise the blood pressure a little bit, that helps in some patients. And so, you know, we can dial in medications for POTS and for orthostatic intolerance or cerebral hypoperfusion that way. And then we can also look at autoimmune components, see if there's anything there that needs to be addressed, and vascular compression syndromes, which I think are prevalent in this population. And it's sometimes treating those that kind of puts, that gets us to the next step of functionality for patients. So that's a lot of stuff.
It is a lot of stuff. And, you know, I guess keeping the messages simple for patients is important too, because it is so complex.
Yeah. So, I mean, ideally, this is all done over the course of multiple visits that are not far apart from each other, so that you can focus on kind of one direction at a time, one instruction, so that we can, you know, not overwhelm anyone with too many things. But at the same time, you don't want to just say, I don't want to say to a patient, okay, here's one medicine. I'm going to start you on Allegra, you know, and I'll see you in 6 months and let's see if you feel any better. I mean, that's, it's like, well, what do I do for 6 months if it doesn't work? Or, you know, if it works and then I'm still feeling badly, I feel a little better, but I don't, you know. And so this is another part flaw of the medical system, right? These patients do best if you can really see them every 4 weeks and help, you know, have someone call them in between. You know, are you taking the steps that Dr. Cutchin said? Are, you know, she prescribed these three medicines. She wanted you to start with this one first. Did you start it? If you did, are you feeling better? If not, let's stop it and try the next one she said to try. You know, so you have some stepwise approach so that patients feel like they can work through an algorithm a little bit that's agreed on between me and the patient and have someone who's helping them kind of holding their hand through this process. Because as you know, these patients are, they see me for 90 minutes and they're totally overwhelmed. I completely understand that. I throw a lot of information at them and I talk really quickly. And then, you know, they leave and they're like, what did she just say? I don't even know where to start. And so having that continuity of care and that close follow-up so that we can check in is ideal, but not totally feasible in modern medicine unless you come up with that algorithm yourself, right?
Yeah, it's very interesting you should say all of that, because for Emerge Australia, we run a patient telehealth service. Our rules in Australia around telehealth working with clinicians are that you have to go and see a clinician face-to-face once a year in order to be able to access telehealth, which of course for people who can't go out, telehealth is godsend. But we have in this country a lot of people who hardly ever see their doctor because of that one regulation that says they've got to have a face-to-face, which you know, we are trying as an organization to work with government to create change there. But the other thing that you raise is not only continuity of care, but shared decision-making, which is something that's close to our heart. We're going to be launching in the next 3 or 4 weeks our first ME/CFS shared decision aid tool. And we've got another two coming out before the end of the year. It's creating systems that allow someone like yourself, a specialist in cardiology, to be able to then work with either a practice nurse or someone that is able to do, or an organization like Emerge Australia, who has trained nurses working on our telehealth line, to be able to take that systemically to the next level and do that regular follow-up with that obviously you can't do because you're seeing all these patients. It's something that systemically we haven't yet managed.
Yeah. And I mean, we haven't either. It definitely doesn't exist here. And I think it's so valuable, right? And so if there's, especially in this population of patients that's really struggling to, you know, remember to take their medications on a daily basis, let alone like remember what the doctor said in the office visit or try to read the note with all of the instructions, it's totally overwhelming and feels discouraging to them. And so I think that's great if you're, you know, to have a helpful organization that can kind of take the recommendations that are given by a specialist and help the patient work through them and really get to where they need. That's part of this management strategy.
And that also leads to, I guess, the issue for Australia. It may not be, I don't know how similar it is in the US, but we actually have very few specialists that we can even refer patients to, or that our GPs can refer patients to, because as you know better than me, someone can go to the doctor and they're feeling wretched. They've got no energy. They've got all the symptoms of whether it's ME/CFS or POTS or mast cell activation syndrome. And typically a GP who doesn't know anything about these conditions will say, I actually can't help you. You should go and see a specialist.
Right. And then there is none.
And there is none. And
I know. Or you have to wait 2 years.
Yes. Yeah.
I know. So it blows my mind. So, you know, one thing I'm trying to develop is a course for primary care physicians to help with the basics of management of this population of patients, just to get some knowledge out there so that little simple first steps, you know, while you're waiting for the specialist, why don't you try these things maybe? But also, you know, going back to the shared decision-making comment, I think the other key in the story of caring for this population of patients is that we have no approved medications for POTS or approved medications for ME/CFS, or, you know, our FDA has not, you know, put a stamp of approval on anything, right? And so anytime I give a medication to a patient, it's a conversation about, you know, well, this medication is not for POTS specifically. It is going to help your heart rate, and it's been FDA approved for other, you know, blood pressure management or heart rate management, but it's, you know, it's off label. Everything I do is off label. And the patients have to understand that. And sometimes it's a conversation about more risky drugs like blood thinners or, you know, something else that might have a little bit of risk. I mean, we have to discuss that I'm not using it for an FDA approved purpose. And that's part of what holds people back in medicine. Also, you have to be willing to do that. Right? Yeah. There's not a lot of people who are willing to prescribe drugs in that way and have that conversation with the patients and trust that the patient trusts them. And so I think that limits practitioners, you know, if you don't want to take that next step, that leap of faith that you are going to work with your patient to understand the risk and the benefit of treatment option and move forward with it, right?
Are there penalties in the United States for doctors who do prescribe off-label?
No.
Yeah.
As long as you're prescribing FDA approved drugs, yeah. You know, if they're approved for something else. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's not the case in Australia. So,
wow.
Yeah. So our clinicians could be severely penalized by prescribing off label. And so that's just another little hurdle that we have to overcome in this country. We are actually quite behind some of the practices that are happening in the US and elsewhere. And funnily enough, you know, other diseases, for example, breast cancer drugs, et cetera, where there has been success in breast cancer treatment by prescribing off-label medication, that kind of has seemed to become a little bit more de rigueur, should I say. But in ME/CFS, there's a huge reluctance by our clinicians to prescribe off-label. And so that leads me actually to really talking about unmet needs within the current healthcare system. And, you know, what are some of the unmet needs in your healthcare system for those living with severe ME?
I think it's access to care. I think that we don't have enough doctors who specialize in this population of patients. And so they're really suffering from, you know, finding doctors who they can get treatment from and get a diagnosis from. I think that's the biggest hurdle. I mean, everything else is kind of minor compared to the fact that it's just impossible to get in with a doctor that specializes in this, right? And or it's financially unattainable for patients. So I think that's the biggest hurdle.
One of the things that Emerge Australia does, and, you know, we're one of the only national organizations, I know the POTS Foundation is doing this as well, is clinical education. And how does clinical education occur in the United States, given your vast population and, you know, your system of governance that is very localized?
Yeah. Right. So I think this is a tricky thing, right? Because we're all practicing in silos and we have lots of continuing medical education. So there's a conference, you know, there's the American Heart Association meeting every year. There's American College of Cardiology. They meet every year. There's subsets to that, like the electrophysiology group and the heart failure group. And, you know, and so everyone has their own little piece and go to the national meeting and you learn about the latest and greatest techniques for taking care of patients with heart failure, right? And this is across the board. So rheumatology has their meeting and allergy and immunology have their meeting. And
those, yeah, yeah.
Right. And, you know, there are emerging groups who are having meetings for things like long COVID or, you know, Sjogren's or mast cell activation syndrome, but still they are siloed and you have to want to go to one of those meetings. Yeah. And you have to go to the meeting and you have to listen to the lectures, right? And that's how doctors kind of get their continuing medical education and get more knowledge about how to take care of these patients. I mean, there's also, you know, the literature, obviously, you know, reading papers and research, review articles, but there's just not a lot of people that are putting out that information that kind of crosses all the spectrums of what these patients actually have. It's still subspecialized in what's coming out as education for physicians. And I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah, it is a huge challenge. I mean, for us, it's just trying to encourage our federal government to actually put some money behind clinical education mm-hmm. for these conditions, which they don't currently. And so it's up to organizations and like ours, like the POTS Foundation, to, you know, do this without any funds. And, you know,
yeah.
Nobody else works without any money. Why should we?
And you're working for a population of patients that can't work.
Yeah.
And so they're not funneling in a whole bunch of funds into that's your right. system.
That is a huge challenge.
Yeah.
It's a huge challenge, yeah. which really underscores why we need to all work together on one agenda. I'm going to go just, I know that I've got one final question, but I'm just going to go sideways a little bit. Can you talk a little bit about the impact of or the influence of the gut microbiome in these conditions? Because it's something my mind comes up a lot. And how much does the gut microbiome influence energy levels?
That's a very good question that I don't think I'm maybe the right person to answer, but I can try. I do think that the gut microbiome is very important. It's basically another system that's living inside us that is also working symbiotically with our bodies to help in a lot of ways. We know that there's serotonin release, there's, you know, hormone release, there's regulation of the immune system. All of this is happening on this microscopic level in our gut microbiome, and you need to keep it thriving and make sure it's populated with the right organisms and through your diet and other things. For patients who have ME/CFS and maybe mast cell activation syndrome or other conditions that limit the foods that they can eat or limit what they can, you know, the gut motility. So you have, you know, overgrowth of some bacteria and not enough of others. And then you start getting, you know, bacteria in the wrong places. And then it just throws the whole system off. And so your immune system really suffers from the lack of an organized gut microbiome. And so it's very, very overlapping, but I don't think there's enough information, or at least it's data I'm not aware of, or I don't have a huge piece of, on exactly what to do to kind of maintain that microbiome appropriately and utilize it or structure it in a way that's going to help someone with ME/CFS, right?
Yeah.
But I think this is emerging stuff, and you know, we have to be very careful about what our microbiome looks like and what we're doing to it.
Yeah, thank you for that. I just had to go off script because it's something that I think about a lot, you know, because mm-hmm. you think about, you know, in disease, you know, is it diet? Is it, you know, are there other influencing factors that influence these?
So it's
the body's capacity
yeah.
to make and create energy.
Yeah. And I think it's also an interesting topic. You know, there's a lot we don't know. I think when I start seeing patients with long COVID or when some new patient comes to see me, you know, oftentimes they have a history of frequent infections. Like as a child, they had lots and lots of ear infections, right? And so they're given lots of antibiotics. And then they've been told, well, because I had so many antibiotics and as a child, my microbiome has been destroyed. And that's why I'm so sick now. And I would argue that maybe there's a component of that, sure. But why were you getting so many infections that needed to be treated as a child?
Yeah.
Why did you need the antibiotics? It's because your immune system was not healthy yeah. enough to begin with. And it's currently still not healthy enough. And you're not handling these chronic infections that you've had your whole life in the same way someone with a normal immune system would handle them. And so yes, you can blame the antibiotics. They're not helping at all with your gut microbiome. And I get that. And I think that's an important component. But why did you need the antibiotics to begin with? And that's how I look at this population is, what was the underlying reason? Why did you get those infections? And your sister didn't have 10 ear infections in 2 years. You know, you did, but she didn't. You know, what's the difference, right? And so those are the kinds of things we have to be thinking about. And I think that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. That's just such a helpful explanation. Thank you for that. Finally, what hope or positive developments do you see on the horizon for improving diagnosis, treatment, and support for people with severe ME?
Yeah, I think that we're looking, so there's more and more research coming out on connective tissue disorders that's highlighting this immune deficient process, which is kind of what I was alluding to before, which I think is going to give us more information about how to manage these patients. There's also more information and data coming out on inflammatory markers that we can look at in this population. So from a diagnostic standpoint, different inflammatory markers that we might be able to utilize to kind of guide care. I think there's a lot to learn, but I think that what we have to be encouraged by is that patients are learning from each other now in Facebook groups and online and social media. And so that knowledge is being brought back to the doctors. And the hope is that you find a doctor that doesn't dismiss you for bringing them something from the internet. That's a hurdle. But my plea to patients would be, don't get discouraged. If you have to go to another doctor, go to another doctor. You will find one that is willing to work with you on looking for the things that you've found on the internet, right? Because I think that we need patients to figure this out. We can't rely on ourselves. You know, the patients are the ones that know their bodies. Patients are the ones that are doing all the hard research because they're struggling so much. They want answers. So let's listen to them and let's listen to what they bring back to us and work, build on that knowledge together so that we can come up with more and more progress for these patients. So yeah. I think there's hope. I really do. I think we're making steps in the right direction. And I think that more and more people, those of us who take care of patients in this space, are talking to each other. I know that I speak to several different doctors every single day, you know, from different specialties. And we're all starting to realize that we're all kind of dealing with the same population and the same problems. And we might be looking at it from different ways. And it's that perspective that's going to help us all get to the next stage with this population of patients.
Yeah. That's a very hopeful way of looking at it. And also, it just reminds me of your acronym that you mentioned in the presentation I heard you give, which is LIFT. And I think that from a GP's perspective or a clinician's perspective, the listen, investigate, find the cause and treat. I thought that was pretty nifty. Do you want to just quickly?
Yeah, I don't know if that was mine. Was that mine? I'm not going to take credit for that, although I do think it is essential.
Yeah. It wasn't yours. Well, isn't that wonderful?
But I think it's a great acronym. And I think that it is what we need to be doing. You know, listening to these patients is so important. And I think doing that is the first step. And if you're doing that as a clinician, you're already making progress with these patients.
Yeah.
Because they're looking for someone who just is going to listen. And listening alone starts giving them hope, and hope gives them more power to recover.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Alexis, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I've got so many other questions that have come up for me, but we need to allow you to go back and have a lovely evening in New York and starting our day here in Australia. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I won't exclude coming back to you at some stage further down the track, because I think
I'd love to.
A lot more wisdom. So today's podcast is part of the Emerge Australia series recorded for Severe ME Week 2026. Our podcasts continue to be a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID and overlapping conditions. As Emerge Australia concludes a federal government funding cycle, we prepare to seek renewed investment. and Emerge Australia is proud to be launching the Count ME campaign, a powerful movement to highlight the need for continued momentum and growth in support of patient services, dedicated ME research, clinical education, and health policy change for Australians living with these chronic and complex conditions. Through Count ME, we will continue to shine a spotlight on groundbreaking developments surrounding these misunderstood and stigmatized conditions and provide critical insights to equip decision makers and better ensure appropriate support to effectively meet the needs of our community. Dr. Alexis Cutchins, it's been such a pleasure, and thank you so very much for joining me today and giving up some of your precious time for us here in Australia. We really appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you.
Tune in again for our next interview, and don't forget, for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter or find out ways in which you can support our work, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au. Thank you again, Alexis, and bye for now.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join.